Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training in Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, The Important Role of Clinical Trials. This is such an important workshop, and I know many of you have questions about clinical trials, and this is the program where you're going to get the answers. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 813 participants. There's a lot of you on the call, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities. You come from suburban areas as well as rural and frontier communities. We also have international participants from Canada, the Dominican Republic, Greece, Ireland, Poland, Puerto Rico, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations with their websites as a really helpful resource to all of you. And there is an evaluation form. I'm going to ask you all to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. We so rely on your feedback on those evaluation forms because, you know, your feedback really helps us to develop programs that are most useful to you. You can tell us and recommend topics that you would like us to do moving forward. So take a moment and please complete those evaluation forms. Thank you. And today's program is made possible by an independent educational grant from Merck & Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Lowell Anthony. Dr. Anthony is Professor of Medicine, Section of Hematology Oncology, Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center. Dr. Anthony is going to provide an overview of the importance of clinical trials, how and where they are conducted, and how clinical trials contribute to treatment options. It's now with my pleasure to introduce the program over to Dr. Anthony.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a real pleasure to be speaking with everyone today about the importance of clinical trials and how they really make a difference in cancer care. Clinical trials form the basis of medicine advancing to the next level. Some advances are going to be bigger than others. When we say clinical trials, we're moving into the unknown. That is, we don't know exactly what the outcomes are going to be. The intent of a clinical trial would be to improve the standard of care. This could be at any point in the delivery of cancer treatment. And cancer care would be potentially quality of life, could be quantity of life, and could be looking at mechanisms of how the intervention may be influencing the outcome. When should someone be thinking about the clinical trial? Well, when the standard of care does not meet expectations, then we look towards investigative approaches to improve these outcomes. We think about how and where are they conducted. These would be facilities that are approved, that have administrative people and research people in place to do the to have the infrastructure to enroll people in clinical trials, explain to the patients what that is, and then to actually conduct the clinical trials, and then to report the clinical trials. So clinical trials are conducted in many university centers, in cancer centers, in private offices. They're conducted really anywhere that the investigator or the physician, whoever is in charge of that, what their interest might be. So it's common within clinical trial centers for trials to be devoted towards certain topics related to certain investigators. How they are conducted, in general, they're conducted in different phases of clinical research. When we talk about the initial phase of phase one, this would be where we really don't know the dose to use, so it's a dose-ranging trial, and from that we get safety information. How the drug is thought to work from the preclinical data will influence what someone might be told to expect from the particular class of drugs that are being tested. Who would be a candidate for a phase one trial? That would be someone who would have fewer or less choices available to them, someone who may have completed standard of care, and something else is indicated based on that person's performance status and expectations on what they're attempting to achieve, their philosophy, you may say. What's the chances of benefiting in a phase one trial? Less than in other phase trials potentially because less is known. So a phase one trial, you may look at it as more humanitarian in many respects, attempting to define what safety parameters, what safety signals are being given so that the next phase, which would be phase two trials, could be conducted. When we talk about phase two trials, now we have a reasonable notion, not final or perfect notion, but we have a reasonable notion of what the dose should be. And in that phase two trial, those doses are tested in specific disease types, which is unlike the phase one trials. So it would be typical to see a phase two trial of drug X in breast cancer or in metastatic breast cancer or in lung cancer. So it's very disease specific. So out of phase two trials, what kind of information do we get? Well, some are randomized. Some may be all that needs to be done. If it's a highly active drug, maybe that would be enough to define the role in future treatments. But usually that's not the case. What comes out of phase two trials is response rates. How does that particular disease respond to that drug at that dose? From that information, the question becomes, is it equal to or better than standard of care? And that means a phase three trial is conducted. So a phase three trial is typically going to be randomized, and the control arm would be the standard of care, whatever that might be. Our intent in a phase three trial is that the investigational arm would be equal to the control arm or better. So that's the, you may say, the carrot that would provide the incentive to participate in a clinical trial, because there's some indication that this will be a better outcome, but it's certainly not promised or given. One of the things that is required now of companies that develop clinical trials is they can't just report out the fact that the drug works. They give standard reporting criteria, which might be radiographic response rate, might be overall survival, might be progression-free survival, the statistical data that comes from this clinical trial. But what is required of clinical trials now is to look at mechanisms. You tell me that the drug works, but now you have to tell me, how does it work? So in a clinical trial, there will be, in many clinical trials, there will be a potentially tissue component or a biomarker component in which samples are being collected in order to give us better information on who might respond better within the population. So if we're looking at all of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, there may be some subgroups in that respond better to our investigational agents than others. We don't know that up front, but whom the clinical trials conducted and looked and analyzed, and looking back, it may be that the signal then falls out and then can be tested in the next generation of trials to see if that hypothesis that's generated out of that clinical trial is indeed a true observation. Now, when we think about clinical trials contributing to treatment options, we should be looking at it as, you might say, the fourth dimension. We've done everything that would be reasonable, and that could be any of the multimodalities of cancer treatment, radiation surgery, and chemotherapy or targeted therapy, and then what's beyond that? That's why I say it's the fourth dimension. We're looking at agents, looking at projects that are going beyond what the standard is. And it can be a bit scary. When you step off into the netherland, you don't know what to expect. When joining a clinical trial, there will be rules to follow, and it's not up to the investigator, once the clinical trial is approved, to change those rules unless there's good reason. Then there's a very specific process to change those rules. So when you join a clinical trial, it's a bit like joining the military. This is where you have agreed to show up on certain days, and you have agreed to undergo blood testing, x-ray testing, physical examination, and in return, the drug is administered to you. That center that enrolls you is responsible for following you and reporting on you. You can transfer centers if someone moves. That certainly is possible. And if someone can't show up a particular day, then there are variances within the protocol. But generally, if the repeated absences would cause someone to be dropped off the protocol. Now, once you sign on to a protocol, does that mean that you're forever signed on to it? And the answer to that is no. You can withdraw your approval at any time. And the sponsoring institution can also tell you that they're finished. And that sometimes is a little bit disheartening, I think, to everyone. There is this uncertainty if the trial being conducted at multiple centers, all of a sudden gets information that the investigational arm is not being proven in the manner that is outlined in the trial, then there may be a premature discontinuation of the trial. Now, what happens if you happen to be benefiting in that setting? And that's where the investigator can step forward and work with the sponsor and potentially even continue on beyond that. We certainly have seen that in our clinical trials. So what I'd like to conclude my section of this is that clinical trials are from our perspective in being in cancer research, and a very exciting area to be in, particularly now that we're targeting specific pathways. So it's more than just a cluster bomb the genome with chemotherapy drugs, where we just attempting to blindly attack the cancer cell, but now it's more surgical strikes, where we're inhibiting a specific pathway or several pathways concomitantly, but we're getting feedback on what the toxicity may be by inhibiting those pathways and testing what tumors may be active by predicting in vitro and particularly preclinical what may be useful in humans. So I'd like to conclude right there, Dr. Messner, and I'll let you take it.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Anthony. It's a wonderful overview and really a description of clinical trials. And so I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. John Leonard. Dr. Leonard is Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology. He is also Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College, Clinical Director, New York Cornell Center for Lymphoma and Myeloma, and he's Chief Lymphoma Myeloma Service Associate Director for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Cancer Center. And Dr. Leonard is going to address what happens in a clinical trial, the meaning of informed consent, and benefits of, and risks of participation. Dr. Leonard?
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here today. These are very important issues. Anytime a doctor goes into their office with a patient and their family and talks about what's the situation with their disease, what the prognosis is, what the treatments are, what the options are, which is best. It's because people have participated in clinical trials to help provide answers to those questions and to try to move things forward. So thank you all for taking the time to learn a little bit more today, because I think that one of the big problems with the pace of progress in cancer research and in doing better for patients, one of the big problems is the fact that, unfortunately, not enough patients and not enough doctors participate in clinical trials, and so the idea of learning more about them is obviously the first step. A trial's not right for everybody, but for many people, it may be a very good option to consider. So for the first part of my talk, I want to give a sense of what happens in a clinical trial, and this obviously is very dependent on what the particular type of trial is. There are studies that are basically what we call observational trials, where the physician or the team doing the study may say, look, we're not going to do anything to you on this, meaning there's not an intervention, there's not a treatment. We're just trying to learn about the disease. So they may say, can we collect information on you? And that may be just looking through your medical records, asking you some questions, taking some blood samples or other samples from biopsies and other things. And those are, in some ways, the easiest types of trials from the standpoint of they tend to be relatively easier for patients, and it's providing information that will hopefully be used as it is analyzed in conjunction with many different patients, what information is useful to move things forward and to learn about the disease and how best to treat it. Most of the time, though, when we talk about a clinical trial, what we're talking about is a study or a program. And one of my patients said, why do you call it a trial? Because a trial is a trial and tribulation. You should call it, going on trial is not a good thing. But for many people, going on a clinical trial could be a good thing. And certainly that's how we move forward. So the idea is that we're assessing, and as Dr. Anthony said, we're assessing a new treatment approach. And so when we're talking about clinical trials for cancer, most of the time we're talking about a treatment plan that was developed through a process that is organized to give the treatment plan in an organized, uniform way, so we know it's being done in a consistent way. And then data, information are being collected on how did the treatment work and what were the side effects of it. So for every clinical trial, there is usually what we call a protocol. It's a document. It's a kind of a treatment plan that summarizes all of the information related to that study, the background, the reasons for doing it, the goals of the study, the treatment program, the monitoring that's expected, and really how all of that's going to be measured. So it really governs in advance. It's kind of like not going to your doctor and kind of going along with how things go. It's really, and there are good and bad parts to all this, obviously, but it's saying we're going to conduct this treatment, assuming everything goes smoothly, in a relatively organized way, because that's the way that's going to allow us to get the maximal information, as well as to do this in a very careful manner that we can make sure that we're doing everything right. So studies can be, clinical trials can be initiated from a number of different sources. Some of these are the group of doctors or physicians or researchers at an individual center can come up with an approach and decide to test a treatment program just in that center or with perhaps a few other centers and physicians. However, most of the studies overall that are done are in the United States are either initiated or designed in collaboration with the National Cancer Institute, which has a number of different cancer cooperative groups Some of those are called CALGB or SWOG or NSABP. These are groups that in many cases have been around for decades, and it's centers across the country working together to cooperate and collaborate to try to develop new treatments and to do it in a way where things can be done uniformly across various centers, because some of these treatments can't be developed just at one place with a few patients. You may need several hundred patients to participate. So the important thing I think that's relevant to this also in the U.S. I didn't mention is that many of these are trials are either initiated or conducted in collaboration with pharmaceutical companies, because companies develop drugs and companies are an important part of how we're moving forward with cancer, because as companies bring resources forward to develop new drugs and new treatments, this obviously contributes, hopefully, to patients having access to new treatments and demonstrating that new treatments work, or if they don't work, that we move on to something else. And so the process of going from an idea, i.e., I think I have a new drug or a new treatment approach, to actually studying it in a clinical trial is a very long process. And some people would argue that it is too complicated and takes too long because that may slow down progress. On the other hand, others would argue, and I think patients should take some reassurance in the fact that this process largely exists to make sure that, A, we're doing it right, and, B, to try to protect patients from any problems that can come up and to make sure that we're doing these things in as safe a manner as possibly can be done. And so by the time a physician or a research team, a nurse, is in a position to offer a patient a trial, depending on the type of trial, that has been worked on by the people involved for months and months. It gets the idea or the concept may be developed. That may go forward to, let's say, a sponsor if it's a pharmaceutical company, or the government committees or the research groups sponsored by the National Cancer Institute, and they all have processes where different people look at different aspects of the study. They review the study. They make sure that it's being done in a very rigorous way. So it's not just somebody cooking up something and saying, well, I'm going to treat 30 patients. It's really a very long and detailed process to make sure everything is being done in an organized way. Depending on the type of study, many studies are also reviewed by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration of the government, that makes sure that what's being done is organized and appropriate, and that all of the safety and other data that need to be in place to make sure that this is an appropriate and safe thing to do, to study, have been done. And then at each institution, locally where the study is done, there is what's called an institutional review board that is basically a committee made up of a combination of different physicians and nurses and pharmacists and different personnel, including patient representatives, that reviews the study and makes sure that it is an ethical thing to do, that it is being done in the safest and best way possible, and that the consent form, the information being provided to patients, is accurate and reflects what's going on. And we'll get to that issue in just a second. So the point being that there's a lot that happens as far as going on a clinical trial before it's even in a position to offer to a patient. Now, patients may hear about a study, they may hear about it through various sources like the internet and elsewhere. They may be offered this or referred by their doctor to a place, or offered by the doctor if the doctor participates in the study to participate in the trial. And part of that is called informed consent. And so the idea being that this study has to be presented to the patient and their family or friends or whoever's involved in making the decision to participate in a very honest and organized fashion, so that you know what to expect out of the study, you understand why it's being done, you understand how it could possibly help you, how it might not help you, how it could hurt you, based on what's known and the reason and the rationale for doing it. And then exactly what's going to happen, how many tests, what's the schedule of treatment, how's it going to go, et cetera. And so that is a very, very important process of all this, is making sure you understand what you're considering and making sure it's the right thing for you to do. And in some ways, this is a daunting process because many institutions have a very long document they give give you that's maybe 20 or 30 pages long that describes everything under the sun that can happen, but it's really something that is designed to really give you a good understanding of what's going on. And I think the most important thing is not just to rely on this document, which can be challenging to get through, but make sure you have all of the information you need. Sit and ask the physician, the nurses, whoever's involved with the study to go through things with you. If you have any questions, bring your friends or your family with you to help you assess this. You might want to bounce the idea off other physicians, for instance, your family doctor, if you're being offered the study by your oncologist, just to get another perspective on things. But the idea of informed consent is to make sure you fully understand. Now, as Dr. Anthony said, and I'll wrap up my section here in just a second, I think that studies offer patients lots of benefits and some potential risks. One of the more obvious benefits is you're contributing to understanding and learning about the disease and how to treat it potentially better, potentially not better. Many studies, again, you may not benefit from, and it's possible that you could have side effects from being on a study because the treatment has some side effects that you wouldn't otherwise be exposed to. On the other hand, there are some situations where studies are moving toward better or less toxic or more effective treatments. Often we don't know this, and we don't want to overpromise or we shouldn't overexpect that. But in some cases, certainly in cancer, a treatment may offer a new option, something that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get that could potentially benefit you. The other thing is that studies are often being conducted by physicians and treatment teams that perhaps are more expert in the field because they're involved and active in not only just treating patients, but moving the treatment and the understanding of that disease forward. So you may have exposure to teams of doctors and nurses that know a little bit more than the average person about these diseases, and that could help you. You also get monitored very carefully while you're on a clinical trial. And one of the challenges for some people on clinical trials is that, as Dr. Anthony said, you will be treated and monitored kind of in an organized way on a schedule, and that can be challenging because it may take some extra time and effort. It often does. But on the other hand, you're being watched very closely for any side effects. And in some ways, some people think you could get better medical care because you have more people looking over each other's shoulder as you get treated. So I think that there are I'm going to finish up my part here, but I think that there are it's very important to understand, and Dr. Mitchell is going to talk a little bit about this in her section. It's very important to understand what you're considering, what's being offered, and I think it's important to know that there are potential benefits, although not everyone benefits, and really understanding the individual situation that you're considering will go a long way to sorting out whether or not a trial is for you.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Lena. That's really excellent. And really, I think people have a better understanding of informed consent and the benefits of participation, how important participation can be. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our third speaker is Dr. Edith Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell is the Clinical Professor of Medicine and Medical Oncology, Department of Medical Oncology, Associate Director of Diversity Programs, Kimmel Cancer Center, Thomas Jefferson University. Dr. Mitchell is going to address specific questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trials, accessing resources for clinical trials, and your quality of life concerns. I'm now going to turn this program over to Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you very much. I'm so pleased to be able to speak with you today, and I'd like to thank Dr. Messner for the opportunity. I'd like to thank Dr. Leonard and Dr. Anthony for working with me on this presentation. And I'd like to thank all of the participants because it's really the patients and their families that drive clinical trials, and it's what it's all about. So thank you. Now, as you've heard from the other speakers, most clinical trials are really developed with the overall intent of improving cancer care. Sometimes it is to actually treat the cancer. Other times it's to improve side effects or quality of life. But the overall intent, whether it's a phase 1 or 2 or 3, whatever kind of trial, It is designed with some idea in mind of improving overall cancer care. So what do I mean by that? Well, if you think about was the standard of care. It removed not only the breast and the lymph nodes under the arm, but it removed all of the muscles off the chest wall. And many patients had significant side effects from that. So if you think about if we never did any clinical trials, today we would not be doing lumpectomies and breast preservation. Or think about the drugs used to treat not only breast cancer but others. But just focus on breast cancer. If there had been no clinical trials, we would not have a tamoxifen or a Herceptin or Adriamycin or any of the other medications. And it's not only in terms of medications, but think about radiation. If we had not had clinical trials, we would not have limited field irradiation where we did not do damage to other organs that might be nearby and with such curative effects for the cancer. And then for the side effects of treatment, think about nausea and vomiting, which all patients on cancer treatments are concerned about. But think about if we had never completed clinical trials, there would not be a Zofran or other medications. And then for general medicines for prevention, simple things like Tylenol, aspirin, the statins, if there had not been clinical trials, none of these medications would be available for treatment. So clinical trials are very important, and the overall goal is to improve care. So with that, first of all, where do you get information on clinical trials? There are many sources, and I don't want to give a list of them today, but there are at least two really good sources that one could start with, and clinicaltrials.gov is an NIH, or National Institute of Health, site, and it has all of the important clinical trials from the National Cancer Institute, as well as others, so it's an important place to look. There is another site that is operated by the Coalition of Cancer Cooperative Groups. This is also an area sponsored by the National Cancer Institute. It's called Trial Check, so that's another good area to look for trials. Another third area that every patient should ask is their healthcare provider team, the doctor, the nurses, the pharmacists, and others who are taking care of them, so that there is a clear communication channel from which you obtain information and so that the healthcare team knows what you're looking at. But let's talk about why become involved in a clinical trial and who should you ask. For most cancers or cancer conditions, one can ask the doctor or the nursing team, is there a clinical trial in this area? Because no matter what stage an individual is, there are some clinical trials. No matter how many treatments the patient may have received in the past, all the way from no treatment to multiple treatments, clinical trials are available, and the overall intent is to try to improve care. So therefore, ask your doctor if there is a clinical trial available. And when you think about that, you can ask yourself and ask the healthcare team, the doctors and the nurses, what are the benefits of the clinical trial? How is it likely to help, or what is the potential benefit? And by the same token, you want to know what are the side effects and what are the potential risks to an individual clinical trial. You want to know the medications that might be involved or the technology that might be involved? What are the side effects and what are the adverse reactions? The next thing that one should ask the healthcare team, what is the safety and how is the safety of the patient protected? You will also want to know, does the clinical trial require some of my tissue? And by tissue meaning a piece of the tumor or blood or urine samples or other, that's really very important. And it's really important because if clinical trials in breast cancer, for example, had never been done on tissue, we wouldn't know about estrogen receptors or progesterone receptors or ERBB2 or HER2 receptors or for any other type of cancer where the target is now known or the target is very important for selection of treatment. So you want to know, what does the trial require tissue and what happens to your tissue after that? The next question that one should ask is, what should you consider before participating in a clinical trial? Is the standard of care basically curative? Do you need a clinical trial in that area? Another question could be, what kind of preparation do I need to make in order to participate in the trial? And is participation in the trial going to delay my therapy? And if it delays my therapy, is that going to affect my livelihood or likelihood of having a good outcome from treatment for the malignancy? So all of these are questions that one can ask. Another question that should be asked to the healthcare team, to the doctors and nurses and others taking care of the patient, who sponsors that trial? Dr. Leonard mentioned that sometimes the National Cancer Institute sponsors trials or pharmaceutical companies may sponsor the trial. But you'll want to know, who is the sponsor? What is the protocol? What are the medications or technology or what are the processes involved? And is there a placebo? Are you really going to get treatment or is this a comparison to a standard of care where you may not know, but you really want to know what is involved in the trial? So you want full details on everything that happens to the patient. Other things are, does my insurance cover this clinical trial? Is it likely that I might have to pay more money out of pocket to participate in the clinical trial than if I received the standard of care? So those are all questions. And then you'll also want to know what type of clinical trial. You've heard earlier that there are differences between phase one or phase two or phase three studies, so you will want to know what type of trial. So while there are many methods of obtaining information from the libraries, from the internet, I think the best place to start is with the healthcare team providing your care. And that should start with your doctor, your nurses, your pharmacists, and others providing care to you. And then one can expand from there. If you're going to look at internet sources, I would at least start with clinicaltrials.gov because that's a really valid site where you're likely to get, one, good information, but also very true and real information. So with that, Dr. Messner, I would like to conclude and again thank all of the participants today and thank all of the participants who have ever participated in a clinical trial because they are very important.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mitchell. And, you know, I think that's such an excellent point that we're happy to have all of you on the call today and all of you who have participated in trials. This is so important as well. It really has advanced the standard of care. And now I just really want to thank all of our speakers. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and I'm going to ask her to bring on all of our speakers so that we can be sure to address your questions as fully as possible. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, if you do have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. One moment for our first question, please. We do have a question from Joanne W.
Yes, this is a very timely lecture because this week you probably saw an article in the New York Times about how drugs are stirring a debate on rules of clinical trials, and it talked about a study that is being done with a melanoma drug, and I guess it showed a lot of promise. So I guess I wanted you to comment on how do you, when a drug shows a lot of promise, what happens to the control group? How does that work who doesn't get that drug?
Thank you. That's an excellent question, Joanne. Dr. Lenz, would you like to address that question?
Sure. So that was an article, for those of you, you heard a little bit, but it's basically an article talking about a drug that many people, many physicians and patients felt had a great deal of promise or feel that has a great deal of promise in melanoma, although also, and so there was some discussion as to whether or not a comparison trial, i.e. comparing this new drug to one of the standard drugs, which is a chemotherapy drug that in this case is pretty limited in its effectiveness, whether or not that was even necessary. So randomized trials where one group gets the standard and one group gets the new treatment, it may be the standard plus something new or it may be an entirely different thing, is very, the concept of a randomized trial is very important. Because one might argue, well, why don't you just take a number of people and let them pick which they want and compare them? But the issue is really that you might find that all the healthier patients end up in one group and the sicker patients end up in another group for various complicated reasons. And so you don't know if a treatment looks better because the treatment is actually better or because the treatment is the same or no better, but the patient group just happened to be better, and that's what's responsible for how one thing might look better than another in a comparison. So randomized trials are very common in oncology and other areas of medicine as well. In oncology, people ask, well, what about placebos? And it's pretty rare for a placebo. It would have to be a very special situation where a placebo would be used for an oncology drug. Now, from the standpoint of whether or not such a randomized trial is appropriate, i.e. the treatment, the standard treatment perhaps isn't so good, and one might think that the newer treatment or different treatment is so much better that it would be wrong to even do that. Well, I think it's complicated and it depends on the situation. What I would say is that these sorts of trials, number one, are very important, and before such a randomized trial would be designed and approved, there would have to be agreement by both scientists and patient representatives and others, including the FDA, that it is ethical and fair to do that randomization. In other words, that it would be reasonable to treat a patient one way or another. And so that is, you know, when one talks about a randomized trial, it really is something that, generally speaking, is one that is has a lot of thought has gone into it. Now, if it turns out that one drug, as is thought in this particular case that was in the New York Times, is so much better, then studies are monitored very, very carefully, and it would be the sort of thing that in many studies you wouldn't necessarily wait and treat hundreds and hundreds of patients to find out. If one was so obvious, most studies have built into them that you would stop early and figure out the result early if there's such a dramatic benefit to the new approach. And then finally, in my last point, and I've taken a little time, but I think this is an important one for patients to keep in mind, is that, you know, we may often think that we know something is better. So your doctor may say, oh, you don't want to go on a randomized trial, but, you know, we know which one is better. We're just going to give you the thing that's better. But unfortunately, unfortunately, that's not always the case. And for example, in breast cancer, bone marrow transplants were done for many years because everyone thought it was such the right thing to do, and it was so much better than the standard treatment that people argued that how could you possibly do a randomized trial? It's so clear that bone marrow transplants are important and better than the standard treatments. Well, in fact, when the randomized trial was done, the bone marrow transplant was more toxic and was no more effective. And so we might think we know the answer. It might seem obvious that one approach is better, but that's not always the case, and that's why we need to do these sorts of studies. So hopefully that answers your question to a degree.
Well, thank you very much. That's an excellent question and great answer. Thank you so much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from James.
Is that for James?
Yes, James. Your question, please. Very happy to have you on the call.
I'm sorry. I happen to be on a clinical trial right now myself with MD Anderson. But the doctor previously answered my question for me. Thank you very much, doctor.
Thank you, James. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Sabrina P.
Sabrina P. in Chicago?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'm surprised. I didn't know that was my name. But the reason why I'm asking, the question I'd ask is, I'm a strong believer in research, and I lost my husband to cancer in January of 2009. He was participating in the Tarsila, clinical research. And I'm wondering, please, participating in a study, is that determined by one's ability to have access to the study? For example, I'm with Northwestern. Northwestern is one of 61 comprehensive cancer care centers in the world, and or even the nation. And people don't have access to Northwestern. Certain people like in the other surrounding states, like Wisconsin and Iowa, what have you, et cetera, they don't have access to Northwestern. If we were to provide accommodation to those people, would they be able to participate in studies, or is everything contingent on their insurance?
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. Thank you. Dr. Mitchell, would you like to address that?
Oh, yes. So there are multiple cancer centers, National Cancer Designated, National Cancer Institute, are NCI-designated centers throughout the country. And many of those cancer centers also have affiliates that might be other community hospitals in the area where clinical trials could also be obtained. Whether one could move with you, let's say live with you, and then go to Northwestern would depend on the type of the trial, how long you would want the person to live with you, and whether they could go back to their own community and still continue to receive the treatment or the medication. And they vary from one clinical trial to another, so this would be very specific on how often the patient might need to come into the center for whatever the treatment is and how long they will need follow-up after that. So each clinical trial has its specific requirements, both for the patient as well as how frequently a treatment is given and what is the follow-up that is needed after that treatment has been completed. And then every treatment is different based on the disease process and in cancer, what type of cancer, as well as what is the stage of the disease and the performance status of the patient, which means basically how sick is the patient. So there are a lot of parameters that guide participation in clinical trials and a lot of thought process that goes into the design of the requirements for the clinical trial. So every trial is different.
Thank you. Another question that was sent to us electronically is that I'm interested in blood management as Jehovah Witnesses need bloodless alternatives for our treatment. Dr. Anthony, could you address that question?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Carolyn. The care of patients who are Jehovah's Witnesses is very important because there are certain centers that specialize in providing observers and assuring the person that the guidelines of their religion is being followed. Not all centers do that. Centers that do transplant medicine, kidney, liver, et cetera, certainly do see that maybe a little bit more often because of that. But in oncology, what we attempt to do to minimize blood transfusions is to use growth factors that can stimulate the bone marrow and use iron products, either by mouth or IV, to assist. So for oncology care, we're certainly sensitive to it and do everything we can to adhere to their religious principles.
Carolyn, I'd like to add to that, if I may.
Yes, please.
Basically transfusions, and I'd like to add to what Dr. Anthony has said, transfusions make just one way of treating anemia. In cancer care, anemia is a very important aspect of care in that almost 50% of patients might have anemia at the time of diagnosis of cancer, and others will certainly develop anemia at some point during the treatment process, whether it's related to surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, or some combination. So treating anemia is very important, and we have devised, through carefully conducted clinical trials, ways of treating anemia that are not related to transfusion. So there are others, as Dr. Anthony mentioned, the growth factors, but also there are clinical trials that are conducted to evaluate blood substitutes that are not blood and therefore might fit into that patient's religious principles, so that not only do we conduct research on improving cancer, but we also conduct research on supportive care aspects of cancer treatment. So trying to treat anemia and to develop new treatment processes for treating anemia is a very important aspect of cancer care.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. And our next question, Mary?
Our next question comes from Bill H.
Yes, this is Bill H. I'd like to say it's been 9 years that I've had multiple myeloma, and I'd like to thank the one of the comments on how to find clinical trials. But my question is, can I join a clinical trial outside my city and state, or do I have to stay within my city?
Oh, Bill, it's nice to hear from you, first of all, on the call. Good to hear from you. And Dr. Anthony, would you address that question?
Yes, I think that's a really important question because it comes up all the time. The answer is yes. You can join any clinical trial that will accept you and you accept them. Distance, however, may become an issue based on how often you need to be at that center. Some trials will see patients almost at a minimum of once a month, and then frequently drugs are now administered twice a month for some monoclonal antibodies, and safety issues may be such that you may have to, for some trials, be even seen weekly. So what I talk to patients about that is if they have community, if they know of communities where they have family members or extended support, those might be an area where their life is not as disruptive as moving into a neighborhood or a building where they have to establish new relationships and friends, and it becomes really disruptive for them. So I look at that as quality of life even though it's not something that we would impact with drugs. But I think if you disrupt someone's normal routine by placing them in some foreign environment, that's certainly going to be challenging, in addition to the challenges presented by the disease and the treatment.
That's very true, Dr. Anthony. And Dr. Messner, may I just add another bit to that? I always say, and I always refer the patients, talk to your doctor and the doctor's staff about it, because if a patient is in one state or one city and needs to go to another city, maybe for a vacation, maybe because they're moving, they need to talk with their doctors and staff about it, because that doctor might know of someone else in the next city who is doing that same study or who is conducting exactly the same thing or who may be able to assist in the treatment process. For example, one of Dr. Anthony's patients now is here with me, totally different city, but the patient had a job offer, and she is now in our city. So we talk with each other all the time, and we try to assist patients. It is our goal in clinical trials to improve the care of patients, and we certainly try to make available to patients no matter where they live. So we make every effort to guide the patient on where they might obtain the same clinical trial in their own neighborhood, or we try to work with other physicians who we know who might be able to provide the same clinical trial. So always ask your doctor.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've just been extraordinary. It's an amazing call, just an incredible group of physicians. Thank you so much. I want to thank all of you who queued up and asked such wonderful questions. You know, your questions really enhanced our call today. I know there were questions you wanted answers to, but they also allowed everybody else to get those answers too. And all of you who have been listening as well, I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour education program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have so many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I just want to let you all know that although the program will end soon, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those go on endlessly for you. You can contact us at any time. Our services are free. We have a staff of 60 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide practical and financial assistance, to provide counseling, someone to talk to, both individually and also in groups. We do this, we do telephone support groups, and we also do online support groups. And, of course, we have these educational programs. We have a whole program which helps children who have cancer in their families. We have a Cancer Care for Kids program. And we also have lots of materials and publications, so that there should be something here for everyone on this call. And to some extent, please do not ever feel that you're alone in coping with your cancer. You do have a place always to contact. We're simply a telephone call away, 1-800-813-HOPE, or you can email us at www.cancercare.org, our website. We are here for you, and very much want you to know that these services are for you all the time. So I want to thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.